From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Ever since the early 70s, Nick Lowe has been shaping the sound of rock and roll. He helped found the British pub rock movement, produced artists as influential as Elvis Costello and the Pretenders, performed with Rockpile, and wrote lots of catchy songs, including What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Nick Lowe. Also today, comic book artist Kim Deitch tells us how his work has been influenced by his childhood. His father was the head of the Terrytoon cartoon studio. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by singers Lisa Stansfield and Michael Bolton. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movies House Party and Love at Large. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The state-run Libyan news agency now says that no one was hurt in last night's fire at a suspected chemical weapons plant near Libya's capital of Tripoli. The news agency initially said there were an undetermined number of victims. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi says his government is investigating whether West German intelligence is responsible for the blaze. Gaddafi is threatening to expel West German citizens if the country was involved. A Middle Eastern Muslim organization threatened today to kill three captive American educators unless the U.S. meets some unspecified demands. The group, the Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine, also threatened to attack airlines that are flying Soviet Jewish immigrants to Israel. The three professors were abducted from Beirut University in January of 1987. The development comes on the eve of the fifth anniversary of the March 85 kidnapping of Terry Anderson. President Bush said today that he's not worried about the new powers granted Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. The president credited Gorbachev for touching off the wave of reforms sweeping Eastern Europe. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president said the Soviet Union has come out of the totalitarianism of the past and said that he does not view the broad new powers of the Soviet president as a threat.
I am convinced that one of the reasons we've had peaceful change in Eastern Europe is because of the approach that Gorbachev himself brought to bear on the problem. And I've consulted with him, had communications from him, for example, on the question of Germany, and I think he's a reasonable man.
Addressing a group of newspaper executives, the president said there was much less of a danger today from the Kremlin. Mr. Bush has sent a letter to Gorbachev congratulating the Soviet leader on his accession to greater powers. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The full Soviet parliament has overwhelmingly rejected Lithuania's recent declaration of independence and instructed Gorbachev to defend the interests of the Soviet Union. But as the BBC's Bridget Kendall reports from Moscow, it's unlikely the issue will lead to a confrontation.
Mr. Gorbachev had already rejected the Lithuanian declaration as invalid earlier this week and already ruled out negotiations on the matter. This ruling from the Soviet parliament gives full legal backing to that position. But at his first press conference in his new role, President Gorbachev was anxious not to suggest he would use his powers to crack down on Lithuania. Though there'd be no negotiations, there would be dialogue, he said, both with the Lithuanian people and their government. And he hinted that a new union treaty, the agreement which holds the Soviet Union together, could perhaps offer different republics different types of ties with the center. And if, in the end, a referendum of the republic showed the Lithuanian people themselves wanted to secede, then, as long as the interests of all sides were taken into account, he acknowledged they should be allowed to do so.
Bridget Kendall reporting from Moscow. On Wall Street, prices closed higher today. This is NPR News. An FBI agent testified today in John Poindexter's Iran-Contra trial that Poindexter tried to shift the blame to Oliver North after the scandal erupted in late 1986. Helen Glasser was the first agent to interview Poindexter about the diversion of Iran arms profits to the Nicaraguan Contras. Glasser said that Poindexter told her during a 15-minute interview at his home that North was committed to the Contra program and that North was, quote, up to something. A three-day government spot check of businesses around the country has this week found nearly 43% of those businesses violating child labor laws. NPR's Paz Cohen has more.
Most of the 7,000 violations uncovered at the 3,400 companies targeted by the Labor Department's Operation Child Watch involved minors working more hours than allowed by law. But there were also 900 cases of children working in illegally dangerous jobs. And while more companies are hiring teens between 14 and 17 to compensate for a shrinking labor pool, Labor Secretary Elizabeth Dole said there are alternatives to breaking the law.
If the supply of young people is less than it has been in the past, then they're going to have to think how they can attract workers. That may mean better fringe benefits. It may mean a higher salary.
The Labor Department investigation is still underway. Secretary Dole says fines could amount to $1.8 million. I'm Pas Cohen.
Intelsat engineers are exploring a number of options aimed at boosting the stranded Intelsat 6 satellite into a higher orbit. The $150 million communications satellite was left in a useless orbit yesterday when it failed to detach from a Titan III rocket booster. Israel's government fell today after Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir lost a no-confidence vote in parliament over his refusal to launch the first-ever peace talks with Palestinians. The evening vote on a no-confidence motion proposed by the Labor Party was 60-55 against Shamir. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the British songwriter, singer, bassist, and record producer Nick Lowe. In the 1970s, he helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American Top 20. He recorded several solo albums in the 70s and 80s. His new record, Party of One, is his first in a couple of years. It was produced by guitarist Dave Edmonds, who used to play with Lowe in the band Rockpile. From Party of One, this is Nick Lowe's song, All Men Are Liars. Nicola, welcome to Fresh Air. All Men Are Liars, your new song. I have to compliment you on the line, do you remember Rick Astley? He had a big fat hit. It was ghastly. Was this a rhyme that you had been waiting to use for a long time?
Years and years. No, it just presented itself. You know, the song, it's a, you know, All Men Are Liars. I was really having a pop at that a crappy old record that he had out, you know, that's never gonna let you down, never gonna tell a lie, never gonna be horrible, never gonna do anything revolting at all. And I thought that was really some poor stuff, you know. So I wasn't really having a go at Rick, I was having a go at his song, but it seems to work well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Astley and Ghastly, yeah.
Very good. You in the early 70s played with Brinsley Schwartz, the
yeah.
British band, and you were one of the first groups to actually play the pubs, and this was like considered the roots of pub rock. Can you explain to Americans why it was such a big deal to be playing in pubs?
God, what a great question. You know, it's a really great question, because it's darn near impossible to explain why it was such a big deal. At that time, in England, England's a tiny place, you know, as anyone who goes there will testify. So everybody knows everybody else, you know, especially in the music business. And at that time, the big thing was glam rock then, which nobody who likes music, or liked music rather, really cared for. It's just a fashion thing. That's all England's contribution to the music scene has been for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But the pub rock thing was started, it's just playing, getting back to basics and playing in bars so anyone could just walk in and get a bit of excitement going. But it's you know, you see it happening all the time in America, but in England it's kind of rare, you know, so that's why it's such a big deal, and so it's so difficult to explain what it, you know, to Americans, why it was.
You were also the house producer for Stiff Records, which in the 1970s was one of the first real new wave labels. You produced Elvis Costello's first records. You produced Graham Parker's first record. I'm trying to figure out what my question is here. what was your approach to producing? And I'm wondering if you felt that this was the start of something new, or if it just seemed like you know, business as usual to you.
Oh no! I was very reluctantly thrown into that, really. The only reason I got into producing was because of the three of us who started Stiff Records, which is myself, my manager, Jake Riviera, and his pal, Dave Robinson. I spent more time in the studio than the other two guys had, so I was automatically the house producer. I didn't really want the job, but that was, you know, I was designated that. But in fact, and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, at all. And in a way, that was why it worked, because the people that Stiff signed were all kind of oddballs, you know. So the fact that I didn't know what I was doing sort of only added added to the odd sound of those records. And I still don't, you know, I still don't know how to work the equipment or anything like that. But what I do is sort of wave my arms around and tell a couple of jokes and things, and watch them do it, you know. And if with the engineers, if I get an engineer that I can talk to, you know, I don't say to him, "Hey man, put a bit of 3.4 on channel 26." You know, I don't know anything about that. I'll go more sort of, can you make it go a bit more because it's just going zzz at the moment, or you know, I go, can you make it go jang, or can you make the drum go boing? Or, you know, I make noises like that, and if they're cool, they know what I'm talking about. If they don't, then we're not going to get very far.
I think this has been taken as your credo, but you once said that your approach to producing was bash it out now, tart it up later.
Yes. I mean, you can't do that nowadays. You know, I mean, the same principle applies. You know, I think the same principle still holds good. You know, that you shouldn't worry too much about it. It'll take care of itself, you know. But you know, you hear so many records nowadays that are, you know, as soon as they start, that you're not going to hear a single mistake on there. You know, there's going to be no human hand is going to be visible at all. Like, no humans had anything to do with it. And the vocal, you can tell nobody can sing like that, like they do on records. You know, it's done line by line, by word, in a painstaking and agonizing process. Now, I don't think that this business is that important, you know, to warrant spending the amount of money that a family of four could live on comfortably for a year, you know, in some Ponzi studio making some piece of old claptrap. I just don't see that it's that important. And when it's such poor stuff, you know, it's very, very poor. Most records, I think, I last about 4 minutes listening to the radio nowadays. I think it's rubbish, mostly.
Well, a lot of records really have become a producer's medium, and you start to feel like the singers are really interchangeable.
Yeah,
like, you know,
they're
like
not
any
producers,
voice will do. You just plug in someone onto the voice track.
Well, they're not really producers, these people. You know, I don't think they don't know anything about music. They're engineers who've learned how to type, basically, and they can type out. So they can probably rip you off a couple of faxes at the same time as they're doing the drum machine. You know, and that this stuff just doesn't excite me at all. In fact, I don't dislike it. You know, it's I don't think anything about it. It just goes in one ear and immediately out of the other.
Well, I want to ask you about songwriting, but first let me reintroduce you. My guest is songwriter, bass player, singer, producer Nick Lowe, and he has a new record out called Party of One. Now, I want to play one of your songs that It's a great song. What's so funny about peace and peace, love, and understanding? I'd like to hear the story behind the song, if there is one, and how ironic or how serious you were about the meaning of the lyrics.
Let me see. I thought this song up in about 1973. It's quite an old song, and when I did it as a joke, really. It's so sort of pretentious, you know. I did it on purpose. This sort of as I walk this wicked world, searching, you know, for this and that and the other. I thought it was kind of funny, you know, and then finish off with what's so funny about peace and understanding is the hook, and it was okay, you know, it was pretty good. But then Elvis Costello started doing it in, I don't know, the late 70s or early 80s, and he started doing it in his show, and he still does it. And I don't know, he put something into the words, into the performance of it, that made the words, even though I meant them as a joke, you know, it made them mean something, you know. And the song's sort of, I've changed my mind about the song. I think it's really pretty good now.
So do you sing it more seriously now when you do it yourself?
I think so, yeah. I think I do too, yeah. Maybe because I'm older or something like that, you know. I don't feel quite that it's quite such a joke or something, you know. But it's still it's still not as good as Jailhouse Rock.
Well, let's hear Nick Lowe's recording of What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Nick Lowe recorded in 1974 with the band Brinsley Schwartz. How did you start writing songs?
When I left home with a guitar case in my hand, Lord, which was in 1968, you had to write your own songs. That was the thing to do, you know. Every group, you wouldn't get anywhere unless you had somebody in the group who could write their own songs.
This is the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a lot of really crappy songs about, and I was sort of designated the songwriter of the group. And my initial efforts, you know, it takes a while for you to find your own style. So my initial efforts were really derivative. You know, I mean, I really can't listen to the first records that I did. I don't really listen to my own records at all much, really. But the first ones, I definitely can't, because I can hear really obviously where I was getting my influence from. You know, I, for instance, I used to like The Band very much, and I rewrote their catalogue, you know, several times. The Night They Drove Old Pixie Down, very very obviously. But then you see. Well, in the case of The Band, then I'd read an article about them, and they'd say that they liked Lee Dorsey, for instance. And I'd go, Lee Dorsey, oh, I know him. He did Working in a Coal Mine and Ride Your Pony from the 60s. Right, I'll check him out again. And I'd go and buy a Lee Dorsey album, you know, and think, yeah, this is great. Oh, I can hear how they got that idea and this idea from Lee Dorsey. And then I'd look and see, oh, it's produced by Alan Toussaint. And then I'd find another record, you know, Ernie K. Doe or someone like that, produced by Alan Toussaint. And then it'd be the Meters, and then the Neville Brothers, you know, and slowly you start hearing all this other stuff, and you'd get, and your influences get more and more not quite as refined, you know, more and more obscure, I suppose, if you like. And if you like that stuff, then you'll find your own style inside you. The main thing is that you've got to accept what you are. When you start off, you have this preconceived idea of what you are. You know, I mean, I thought I was this sort of bad dude from the swamps, you know, which I'm patently I'm not. You know, I'm a white middle class English kid, you know, or was a kid, you know. But and once you accept that, then you can get on with it. You know, once you accept what you are, then you get your own style going, and you can relax about it.
When you started, as you say, accepting who you were, did the kinds of songs you were writing change?
No, I don't think so. I've been singing the same song basically since I started. You know, when I was a real kid, the nearest you could get to rock and roll on Forces Radio, because my dad was in the Royal Air Force, and so I lived wherever he was stationed. You know, which is mainly in the Middle East. So I used to listen to Forces Radio. And at that time, in the 50s, you know, it was very, very, you know, it was all Rosemary Clooney and
Perry Como.
Perry Como and that, yes. Which, as a matter of fact, the first record I bought was Magic Moments by Perry Como. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Still do, as a matter of fact. I still think that's wild. But the nearest you could get to any kind of rock and roll stuff was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan. And he used to do, he had this sound, he's called his skiffle sound, which was, heavy acoustic, just thumping acoustic guitars and a real simple bass and drum line, and washboards. He plays washboard thing, you know.
Now I think there's a couple of hits Americans would remember, like does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? Did they do Rock Island Line too?
That's right, you got it. Yeah, Rock Island Line, Cumberland Gap. He used to do a lot of sort of big Bill Brunsey things and Ledbetter songs. I learned all his stuff, and I still really, that's still the same sort of thing I do now, really.
I have always wondered why so many British rockers have been so influenced by Lonnie Donegan, because the records by him I know are Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight, which I think is really just an atrocious record.
Yeah, yes, that was a bit later on. Extremely amusing to English people, but totally. Was that a hit over here, really?
Yeah.
Good grief! No, that was awful. But his early stuff was really great.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is songwriter, singer, bassist, record producer Nick Lowe, and he has a new record out called Party of One. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Nick Lowe is my guest. You know how you said that you're still writing the same song and these are songs mm-hmm. influenced by the Lonnie Donegan days?
Yeah.
Choose a song on the new record that you think is obviously influenced by that.
By Lonnie Donegan?
By the early stuff that you're listening to there.
Oh, I think most of it is actually on the new record, but an obvious example would be Who Was That Man?
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what song I hear in that?
What?
You know Children Go Where I Send Thee? Do you know?
Wait a minute, I think I do, yeah. It's a sort of a spiritual thing,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. That's quite unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Quite unconscious, but great.
Okay.
That's not a bad place to get something from.
So let's listen to Who Was That Man from your new record, Party of One.
Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody knows all across this land. Was that an unknown man? Who was that? Who was that man? It was a wild and wet November night, and the rush hour was at its height. Kings crossed the venue that the finger of death was pointed at. Among the crowd was a lonely soul with a mission in mind and a place to go. Nobody knows where he was bound when his fateful steps took him underground. Who was that? Who was that man? Oh my.
Is this record more of a return to folk in your musical background than previous records have been?
I don't think so. I think touring with Elvis Costello, mm-hmm. he encouraged me to go on tour with him playing acoustically, you know. And I didn't think I could do it, but he really kind of bullied me into it, you know. And I'm really glad he did, because if you stand up on the stage with an acoustic guitar in front of a few people, you soon can tell, you know, if your stuff is happening or not. And it put me back in touch with my own songwriting thing, which I'd lost sight of a little bit. And if folk music means something that you can just rip off on a guitar, then yes. But the thing is that I was listening to some of my old records to try and get an act together, you know, trying to think, well, which one should I do in this act? I had to relearn them again. You know, I couldn't remember how they went. I found that some of the best records I'd made were some of the worst songs, like I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, for instance, is a record of nothing very much. It's a good record, but there's nothing very much there in a song-wise, you know. Whereas a song like Raining, I listened to that and went, oh, man, you just recorded this all wrong. You know, the song isn't there, you know, the way it's been recorded. In other words, you can record a song or make a record. Do you see that there's a subtle difference there?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of records that are really great records because of the way they're produced, because of the way the singer sounds, but the song is pretty insubstantial. It's not one you'd want to pick out yourself. Yeah.
Like Let Me Take You to Funky Town by Lip Sync. You know, that was a really great record, that was, but there's not very much
right.
of a song there.
Right. One of your American releases has a great title, A Pure Pop for Now People. And what is the meaning of pop to you? How has that word changed to you over the years?
Well, popular music is stuff that sells, you know, which patently mine doesn't. You know, the stuff I do is still kind of a secret in the great scheme of things. But the stuff I suppose what I'm known for being a sort of pop guy is because I'm a fan, you know, really, and I sort of imitate the. Or at that time, anyway, I was sort of imitating what people's perception of pop music was, which is like, you know, real throwaway fluff, you know, just rejoicing in its disposability, you know. It always reminds me of sort of like cornflakes ads, you know, jingles on the TV, you know, real disposable stuff. And I like that.
Nick Lowe's new album, Party of One, is on Warner Brothers Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be noted black historian John Hope Franklin. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Nick Lowe's new album.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Kim Deitch was a kid, he used to wander around the place where his dad worked, the studios of Terrytoon Cartoons. Kim Deitch became an underground cartoonist. Although his comic books have an occasional talking animal, reminiscent of Terrytoons, most of his characters are oddballs, cranks, frauds, and extraterrestrials. Coming up, a talk with Kim Deitch. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by singers Michael Bolton and Lisa Stansfield. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new rap movie, House Party, and the new romantic mystery, Love at Large. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Libyan leader Gaddafi threatened today to strike back if West German agents were involved in a chemical plant fire in Libya. West Germany has denied responsibility. In Washington, President Bush denied again today that the U.S. had anything to do with the fire at the plant, which has been suspected of making chemical weapons. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
The fire came 1 week after the administration renewed its accusations that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's government is producing chemical weapons. Administration spokesman denied any American involvement in the fire. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said, "We don't know the origins of the fire. We don't know if it was sabotage." At the State Department, Margaret Tutwiler would only add that,
"We are still assessing the situation, but we believe that there was extensive fire damage."
Tutwiler said the U.S. has been unable to confirm a Libyan report that two people had died in the fire. Gaddafi today announced an investigation into the fire and pointed the finger of blame at West German intelligence services. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A West German television station reported today that a Libyan exile group has claimed responsibility for the fire. One of East Germany's center-right parties has elected a new leader in the wake of a major political scandal. Wolfgang Schnorr resigned his post yesterday after disclosure that he had worked for the East German secret police. Deborah Amos reports from West Berlin.
Today, the members of Democratic Awakening elected Rainer Eppelmann to replace his friend and co-founder of the party, Wolfgang Schnorr. Schnorr was considered a possible prime minister after the elections. The two men were active in East Germany's peace movement within the Protestant Church. Eppelmann was left with the job of restoring credibility to his party after the devastating revelations that Schnorr worked for the secret police. According to reports today, Schnorr's code name was the German word for hypocrite. On the same day, the caretaker government of Communist Party leader Hans Modrow held its last meeting today before the elections. Modrow has become a popular politician, although his party is expected to garner only about 15% of the vote on Sunday. A cabinet spokesman said today that in the past few months, the Communist Party has stabilized East Germany's economy despite the exodus of East Germans to the West. In West Berlin, this is Deborah Amos.
The Vatican and the Soviet Union have established diplomatic contacts for the first time since the founding of the communist state over 70 years ago. The ties fall short of full diplomatic relations. The Vatican and Moscow had diplomatic relations under the Soviet czars, but those ties were broken when the communists came to power. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 8 points to close at 2,695.72, on volume of some 144 million shares. Trading was only moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. This week, British singer Lisa Stansfield made pop music history. Her debut album, Affection, jumped an unprecedented 100 points on Billboard's pop music chart into the top 40. Stansfield is white, but draws heavily on black soul music styles. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that links her with American singer Michael Bolton. But one of the two, Ken says, is definitely more interesting.
When Michael Bolton took the stage to accept his Grammy Award for Best Pop Male Vocal a few weeks ago, I knew the time had come. I knew that if I was a responsible rock critic, I would have to remove the shrink wrap on that pristine Michael Bolton cassette I'd received months ago and actually play the darn thing.
Too proud for crying, didn't come here to break down. My world around the hope that one day we'd be
That's the song that won Bolton his Grammy. His album, Sole Provider, has been on the charts for 34 weeks and has sold over 1 million copies. As the title suggests, Bolton fancies himself a soul man, and he even has the nerve to cover Hoagy Carmichael's Georgia on My Mind in an arrangement that echoes Ray Charles' epic version of the song.
Georgia, Georgia, all day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Talking about Georgia.
As a soul singer, Bolton sings like Bill Medley without Bobby Hatfield. He's an unrighteous brother. Bolton isn't bad exactly. I'd certainly rather listen to his love songs than, say, Neil Diamond's or Billy Joel's, but his popularity has exceeded his interest. A more intriguing singer using roughly the same strategy is the British vocalist Lisa Stansfield.
He should go, and he said things he hadn't said before, and he was so mad, and I don't think he's coming back, coming back. I did too much lying, wasted too much time, now I'm here and crying. I've been around the world, and I can't find my
That song, All Around the World, was a big hit in England and throughout Europe well before Lisa Stansfield's debut album, Affection, was released in this country. Now it's zooming up the charts here as well. Stansfield is singing a different kind of soul music than Michael Bolton. She's digging up stuff that's currently discredited, the creamy 70s disco of Barry White and producers Gamble and Huff's Philadelphia soul style. What Lisa Stansfield has done on this album is to come up with a fresh synthesis, combining the disco soul of the 70s with the beat and urgency of current dance music. Her singing is free of affectation, yet it's still passionate and involved. Unlike so many of her hip Brit contemporaries, she doesn't sing like a robot. At the same time, she avoids all the florid melodrama that a performer like Michael Bolton indulges in. Lisa Stansfield is the voice of the moment.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Too tough to be.
This is Fresh Air. Kim Deitch is an underground cartoonist whose dedication to the form lasted beyond the underground comic movement of the 60s and 70s. You may know his work from Raw, the magazine of avant-garde comics and graphics edited by Art Spiegelman. Deitch's comics are about oddballs, cranks, frauds, cult groups, and extraterrestrials. His recent comic books include Shadowland and Hollywoodland, and he has a new collection called Beyond the Pale, Crazed Comics and Stories. Deitch told me when he was growing up, his father was the head of the Terrytoon cartoon studio. His father was an animator and created several classic cartoon characters for cartoons and commercials.
Well, locally, the local sensation was Bert and Harry Peel.
Oh, for sure.
For Peel's Beer. I guess anybody in the New York area will remember that. But the one that most people, I think, will remember is Tom Terrific and Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. It ran on Captain Kangaroo, oh, for years.
I know when I was young, I used to watch a lot of cartoons. I don't think my parents watched them with me. They weren't much interested. I assume your father maybe watched some cartoons with you. Did he have a running commentary about the style, the animation style? And
he certainly did. Uh-huh. He most certainly did. He would sit there and, you know, he'd look at the old Fleischer cartoons and go, how can they use so many drawings? You know, God, where's the crispness in it? You know, because the budget situation was so different from those days. Compared to what they had to work with in what we're talking about, which is like the late 50s and the early 60s.
Wasn't Terrytoons known as, kind of like the low-budget animation house?
Well, they were really, considered like the schlockiest guys on the block. They operated out of New Rochelle in this big tomb-like, mausoleum-like place that had been there as a studio since 1930, and I'm telling you, as kids, me and my brother, we just love to go roaming through there. In fact, my brother and I are tooling up to do a 40-page story about the early days of animation, drawing on, you know, the fact that we grew up in this business and we knew a lot of these old guys, and we think we're on the verge of something really interesting along those lines.
So you're going to do a comic about the cartoons?
We're going to do for openers is a 40-page story in Raw. We're kind of going to riff on a testimonial dinner that was given for Winsor McCay by Max Fleischer in 1927, at which everybody got drunk. And what ultimately happened was Winsor McCay got so mad that he's in the middle of a speech talking about the future of animation, said, you know, you guys have taken my art and run it right into the ground. Bad luck to you. And, that would be our prologue. Then we'd have this, our version of Winsor McCay. We're going to change his name so we can play fast and loose with the character, but, you know, he's going to urge his protege, for God's sake, don't end up working in one of these schlocky animation houses. And the guy solemnly promises, at which point we immediately cut to 5 years later where he's working in a schlocky animation house. And, on from there.
Did you think or dream in cartoon language? And by that I mean, I know I used to always have these dreams that I'd be driving in a convertible and I'd crash into something and I'd kind of float up into the clouds, you know, because of the impact, and then I'd fly over a little bit and then have to like navigate myself down. But it was all like cartoons, you know?
Well, definitely my hallucinations have a distinct cartoony edge to it. You know, like back in the 60s on LSD trips and what have you, I mean, it was definitely got into all kinds of boffo, funny animal stuff.
Well, was that particularly frightening, or did you enjoy that?
No, it was kind of soothing, you know, because it was a comfortable frame of reference.
Now, you've always drawn comics. Did you ever consider going into animation yourself?
Well, when I was a kid, an early ambition was to get into animation, and in fact, with a friend of mine named Tony Eastman, we used to make animated cartoons, you know, pretty ambitious ones, and later on, you know, over the years, I have worked a little bit in animation. I've designed a spot here and there. My old girlfriend was doing theatrical cartoons, and just because I was there, I ended up working on hers, doing like, you know, all the grunt work like doing cells, but then in-betweening and also doing character voices. So I've always been on the fringes of it without even trying.
You have a cartoon in Raw from the last edition of Raw. I want to ask you about.
Okay.
It's called Carla in Commieland, but there's an autobiographical afterward that's called Little Kimbo in Pinko Land.
Yes, yes, Artie insisted on that.
Okay, well, this now there's a picture of Little Kimbo. That's you, Little Kim.
Yeah.
Sitting in the living room, and he's thinking, "My parents dug modern art and collected jazz records. Their political orientation was hot pink. We were nothing like the neighbors, and it bothered me."
Yes.
And then around you in the living room is a couple, one playing guitar and one playing banjo, and they're singing, "Oh, you can't stop me, I'm sticking to the Union."
It's all true.
Yeah, and then you're sitting on a little Eames chair.
That's right.
Just to show
how
weird the family really was.
How many of those backs did I break, I'll tell you. You can't lean back too hard on those things.
Well, I'm trying to think of an oddball like you thinking, "Oh, my parents, they're so weird."
I looked at the neighbors going to church and being normal. I saw Ozzy and Harriet, too, and took that as the ideal, you know. And so I was bothered by it. Of course, I was a little jerk. What are you going to do? I didn't know what a rich cultural upbringing I was getting, or at least it took me a while to come to fully appreciate it.
So when did you start appreciating the unusual, both in yourself and in others?
Well, I think I always really was, but, you know, in my teenage years. Well, you know, let's face it, I was an oddball in high school, but at a certain point, you know, they kept shoving all these kids' noses in the catcher in the rye. And so after a while, towards the end of my last few years of high school, the Holden Caulfield image was suddenly the thing to be.
Mm-hmm. Were your first comics underground comics?
Yes. Somebody shoved a copy of the East Village Other in my face around 1966, and I saw that, you know, the level of the artwork, you know, was, I figured I could do that. And my brother, who was a bigger comics fan than me, just started shoving my nose in some of the stuff that was being done. Really what happened was that my fine art just kind of transformed into comics. I mean, you couldn't really put your finger on when it stopped being fine art and when it became comics, because it just kind of drifted into it. And like when I quit the straight job, the last one I had, and went to New York City to live, I was going to go down to the Lower East Side, right up to a week before I started doing comics for the East Village Other, I still wasn't quite clear whether I was going to be a painter or a comic strip artist. Although I think a big part of my subconscious mind knew already it had to be comics. It was just in the air at that time.
Your first strip that you submitted to the East Village Other was rejected by them. They said it wasn't psychedelic enough.
That's right. Well, what are you going to do? That's the way things were at the time. Yeah, I had stuff with this little black cat character that I was using at the time that didn't even have a name. And they, you know, I could see they just weren't that impressed. They wanted, you know, they wanted that flower power thing. So I went home, and I smoked a little marijuana, and I gave it to them, and it went over big.
What exactly did you give them?
I gave them a smarmy strip called Sunshine Girl. And, you know, it was just this fat girl going running around doing vaguely superhero-y things. I still meet people that say that they liked those strips, and more power to them if they did. They don't do anything for me anymore.
What did you and didn't you like about the general tone of underground comics from the time?
Well, it was more what I liked than didn't like. I just liked the idea that suddenly comics were developing again, because it seemed to me that, you know, among the popular arts that kind of came in at the turn of the century, and we could put movies in that category, recorded music in that category, that comics got slotted into, you know, business-like categories and stayed there longer than those other arts did. So the fact that comics were suddenly developing, that I was actually in on a pioneering stage of this popular art that was invented at the turn of the century, well, it was just totally thrilling to me, and still is.
Well, what happened to you and to your work as a cartoonist when a lot of the psychedelic underground comics started disappearing?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing is, when that started happening, I was feeling like I was hitting my stride. I feel like I did most of my best work after, you know, the economic situation got pretty dismal. So what happened to me was I said, well, damn it, I'm not through. I'm going to stay in it. And that's what I did, you know, and it was some pretty lean years, and they're still kind of rough, but I've never been sorry.
Now, how did you develop your drawing style? And it's, do you think you could describe what your drawing style is?
Well, I guess you could say it's a primitive artist trying to draw in a quasi-realistic style. I mean, to me, it's kind of, some kind of crackpot realism in my mind. Whether anybody else would accept it as that, well, you know, they have to look at it and tell me.
Well, you use the word crackpot, and there's really a lot of crackpots in your comics. I'm wondering if you meet up with a lot of people like that and get to know them a little bit to explore them for future stories.
Well, sure. Yeah, of course. You know, I'm always striking up conversations with perfect strangers if they seem interesting to me. Because you never know where the next idea is going to come from. And I never really stop looking. I never really stop thinking about the work I'm doing.
So when you're, for instance, say on a New York City train,
yes,
and there's someone sitting next to you who's going to, say, strike up a pretty incoherent but very verbose conversation, you'll keep up your end of it, too, to
I'll
see
give them
happening.
A few miles, sure.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Kim Deitch's comics Shadowland and Hollywoodland and the new book Beyond the Pale are published by Fantagraphics in Seattle. Deitch also appears in Raw magazine. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are watching, of course, the continuing drama of the Soviet Union and the new President Gorbachev and the John Poindexter trial and the testimony of all the Iran-Contra figures. But we have a big feature on today, which was recorded for us by Deborah Wong, is our Asia correspondent in Hong Kong. She traveled out on a boat to intercept refugees coming in from Vietnam and then followed them to the camp and talked to them about what their expectations and possibilities are.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff recommends two new movies, House Party and Love at Large. What they have in common, he says, is charm.
The sound is young, exuberant, and inviting, and so is House Party, the movie it comes from. No one's going to claim that this is a major motion picture, or some kind of must-see, or really anything more than a sweet and modest good time. But in a season of lumbering, overproduced thrillers like Revenge and The Hunt for Red October, a lively little flyspeck of a picture can seem inordinately refreshing. House Party is the first film by a black director named Reginald Hudlin. His brother, Warrington, produced it. And even though the film is a sweetened fantasy of high school life in the black bourgeoisie, the language and music give it a hip, credible edge. The action centers on Kid, played by the young rapper Christopher Reed, who wants nothing more out of life than to rap and dance and make love and, especially, get over to the party at his friend Play's house. Kid has the look of someone whose own sudden puberty has nearly terrified him to death. His eyes bug and his jaw lolls, and his hair shoots straight up from his head like a fez. He's likable, sympathetic, and utterly harmless, and so are his pals. In fact, when it comes right down to it, so are the school bullies who are his enemies. There are no drugs in their lives. And the one kid who dares to drink too much beer is roundly ostracized by his jivey peers. In short, the world of House Party is improbably innocent and upbeat and clean. It's a dream world, but one that's a lot of fun to inhabit for 90 minutes. And while we're on the subject, there's another tiny, improbable, and dreamlike movie you might want to slip into. I'm talking about Love at Large, the latest romantic reverie from Alan Rudolph, who directed Choose Me and Trouble in Mind. Rudolph makes two kinds of movies. love roundelays that are stilted and pretentious because he's trying to make them say something meaningful, and love roundelays that are weirdly seductive because he's not trying to say much of anything at all. Love at Large is the latter kind. It's got Tom Berenger as a detective hot on the wrong case, and Elizabeth Perkins as a detective hot on Berenger. In this scene, the two reluctantly throw in together.
You got something, Stella. I don't know what it is, but you got it. You ever been married, Stella? Yeah, me either. You know, they say marriage is the best thing that's supposed to happen between two people, or the worst. Ever want kids, Stella?
Kids?
Yeah, little people running around with your face.
I know what they are. Yes, I would like kids, but not now.
I didn't mean now. Right. Not at all, now. So who's the man in your life, Stella?
Are you going to call the cops or what?
You still waiting?
Rudolph's dialogue is a weird combination of unbearably arch and outright slapstick. His camera style is woozy and beguiling, and the soundtrack is full of smoky saxophones and late-night muted trumpets. The large and nutty cast includes Neil Young as a gangster, and Ann Archer as the femme fatale, and Kate Capshaw as a down-to-earth ranch wife. And a lot of the acting seems to use phony voices and a considerable amount of tongue-in-cheek. The movie isn't precise or compelling, or even very memorable. But in its own eccentric way, it works. Like House Party, Love at Large is a little trinket of a movie, a wonderfully made bauble like a music box or a cuckoo clock. The perfect thing for an evening when, instead of being shattered or terrified or swept off your feet by a movie, you're in a mood to be ever so gently beguiled.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Wajiva Blaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Hope Franklin tells us about his half-century investigating African-American history. And we meet the man who has everything, including the wrong haircut, rocker Ben Vaughan. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.